Oh, now that's what you mean. Okay. Emily? Is that,
yes.
Okay, who else? I heard a couple of people come in. Some people prefer to remain anonymous, which is fine. I'll wait another minute. Actually, it's already 4:01. Who came in just now?
Neil.
Neil, okay. Very good. I'm going to start now, and as people come in, I mean, we'll just be and at wherever they come in, they'll have to just join us then. Let me just say that in terms of housekeeping, this is one of probably the most difficult lesson for me because the storm hit us hard here, and I had no heat, and it's just been a mess. I'm on a cell phone because my regular phone is dead. Internet is dead. And the man that was supposed to plow, he had a heart attack shoveling snow. So it's been a mess. So anyway, with that said and done, I will begin from where we left off last week, talking about the congregation, Ada, and how we derived the number 10. And the last thing I had said was just as the B'nai Yisrael and, refers to the 10 sons of Jacob who descended to Egypt to get their food during the famine, so too the former verse refers to the sanctification among the children of Israel in the presence of 10. And, that was that. And then I told you I was going to start this week with the obligation of reciting 100 blessings every day. It was very interesting. And then I'll get to, I did send an assignment and that we'll talk about. It was taught in the Baraisa. Reb Meir used to say that a person is obligated to recite 100 blessings every day. Interestingly, this is how they derive it. For it is stated in Devarim, chapter 10, verse 12. V'ata Yisrael ma Adonai Elohecha shoel me'amecha. Me'amecha. Okay. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? By the way, if my phone goes dead, I'll call back. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, because I got something happened there I don't understand. So, it is stated in Devarim, V'ata Yisrael, now, O Israel, what does the Lord, your God, ask of you? And Tosfos, citing Rashi, explains that word ma may be read as if it were pronounced me'ah. So it's a play on words. And me'ah, of course, is 100. Interesting, huh? Thus, the verse can be understood as saying, now, O Israel, 100 blessings is what the Lord your God asks of you. And, of course, blessings is understood. Now, there's a question if the mitzvah of me'ah barachot is a mitzvah d'oraita or d'rabbanan. And I'll ask you what you think. And why? Neil, what do you think?
I'm going to guess d'rabbanan.
Why? Why is even more interesting?
Because some of the things that are included in that 100 hadn't existed yet at the time that the Torah was closed.
Well, yeah, you could say that with a lot of things. I mean, they derive. Okay, Is Bobby Keval on? No. Is who else is on that hasn't announced themselves?
Well, this is Linda Sue Sohn, and I'm not sure.
You're not sure which one it would be?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Richie, let me just say one more thing. What I'm specifically referring to is the fact that it wasn't until after the Torah was closed that the structure of the liturgy was sufficiently codified that you could even get to the 100.
So it's interesting, and it's good that you said that, because now I'll explain something to you that will explain other things. a lot of what is in the Torah was for future, and it was extrapolated. So even though it didn't exist, it still was implanted there, so to speak. So that reason wouldn't be the reason, so to speak. In other words, if you read a lot of Midrashim and even in the Gemara, sometimes it says that even before the Torah was given, a lot of the mitzvot were observed because inherently they felt it. So that's a good answer. But the answer really would be that it's a stretch. In other words, it's almost a homily type of thing, because ma is not mea, and so therefore, you know, there's the Yiddish expression mit groben finger. In other words, it's far fetched in a sense. But the rabbis take it, and they made a takana, and so on and so forth. So it is definitely the rabbanan. You were right about that.
Okay.
Question? No. During the reign of King David, David HaMelech, a terrible plague raged. 100 people per day were dying of unnatural causes. So through Ruach HaKodesh, through the Holy Spirit, King David understood that if the Jews would be careful to recite 100 brachot a day, the plague would be mitigated. So obviously that's very foreign to our theological thinking today. But in that day, that's what was believed. Now, the mitzvah of reciting 100 brachot apply every day. It applies every day. So what's the obvious question you would be asking, seeing 100 brachot have to be recited every day? What is the obvious question you would ask? Think of the whole week now. How can you the obvious question would be, if you have to recite 100 brachot every day, okay, Sunday through Friday is not so difficult, because you have 19 brachot in the Amidah three times a day, so you already have 57. So that's pretty easy, and so on. But what happens on Shabbat?
Wait, isn't 3 times 18 54?
We have 19.
No, but there's 19.
Oh, okay.
19 brachot in the meter.
One was added afterwards,
mm-hmm.
for the heretics. But in fact, when you ask that question, it always bothers me that we call it Shmona Esrei, but that's a historical thing. Now the question is, what do you do on Shabbos and Yom Tov and fast days? How can you get 100? So the answer is, it's not easy, but it has been suggested that on Shabbat and Yom Tov, we should eat various foods in order to make additional brachot. So, for instance, you have a glass of water. There's two brachot right there. You have the one before and the one after. Also, the blessings at Torah and Kiddush count. Even though you respond amen to someone else, it still counts. You're yotze for that. Then when you bench with a mezumen, we can add the two brachot that are made on the kos shel bracha, the wine before and after drinking it, obviously. So then the question is, there's a question whether to begin the counting of the meyah brachot from the morning and complete 100 brachot by the time one goes to sleep at night, or the count begins from the previous nightfall until the next nightfall. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. What is the practical difference?
Whether or not you include Arvit.
No, so you can include it.
You have to start with nightfall, because otherwise you miss the all those brachot in the Arvit service.
No, that's not the question. The question is, you can also start, let's say the count starts from the morning and goes right through the night. You still have Arvit. That's not the question.
You're saying catching Arvit at the other end.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm asking, what is the practical difference? And of course, it's a trick question. There is none.
No
matter how many blessings it is, it's still the same amount of blessings. But I would tend to think, and I think the way it is, that you do start from the night, because generally we do start by here or by Yevoka. We always start from the night. So that would, that would take care of that. Okay. Now, I'd like to touch upon. Did any of you read the assignment that I gave?
Oh yes.
I didn't get it.
Oh yes.
You didn't get it.
I didn't get it.
Okay, this is what I want you. I'm glad, Neil, because it shows that you found it very interesting.
I actually wanted to send you a message saying that you are a brave man for even putting those things on the table.
Well,
boy, was I steaming by the time I was done reading them.
Right, but see, I want you to be aware of what's going on. I because I sent it doesn't mean I concur with it.
I know you don't concur with it. Linda obvious. Sue, what he's talking about is he sent two articles on Coley Shaw.
Can you send it to me?
But the I'm going to have Neil read it. But see, what's interesting about the Coley Shaw, if you followed it, you get some sensible rabbis who have mitigated the whole thing. Did you notice that?
Yes. They're very much in service over this because
exactly.
Are these the two votes from the rabbinical assembly?
No.
These are Orthodox things.
These are. I want to go into strict halacha. The reason, once Neil reads it to you, you'll see why I sent it. Because I'm showing you how even traditional rabbis are troubled, and they have a different take on it, which is very refreshing when you realize what they're saying. So, unfortunately, my computer is down. Neil, would you read that part? Go ahead.
What I actually did is
synthesize
the one that you sent. Sorry, I'm trying to spit my words out here. The one that you sent was part of a series. So I actually went back and read carefully the entire series.
Okay,
just
good.
To see it in context. It's a fight between two rabbis in the Orthodox movement over this issue of what's called partnership minyanim.
Is it online?
Yes, it's online. I sent it to everybody. If you didn't get it, I don't know why.
Is it somewhere else on the web?
Yeah, definitely. I'll send it to you, or Neil will send it to you. It's definitely there. That's why I sent it.
Okay.
All right. So let me, I don't even remember exactly which one you had chosen out of the series, but let me just, for the sake of everybody who's on the call.
Look at the email I sent you, then you'll see which one I sent.
You know what? That's probably the better way, because what I do is I copy and paste these and put them all into a file. Let me go back into my email and try to find
your email. Just because I gave two separate links, and then you can click on the first
you did.
One. Yeah, that would be the best way of doing it.
WOLDERG. He sent this from your home email, I assume.
Yeah, if you put a search, you'll get it that way. I sent it on the 8th of February.
Okay.
It was Rabbi Barry Pendel's response to an earlier article.
Right. Hi, Jack.
Ted Prosner.
Oh, hi, Ted.
Oh, this is Ted. Oh, I'm sorry. Your voice sounds like Jack.
Ted, how about did Benny make it? He's in Florida. He escaped the storm.
Yeah, good time to be out of the Northeast.
Oh, terrible here. Yeah. Go ahead. You got it.
You know what? I'm having trouble.
Was it a link on the web?
It's a link that I sent in an email.
Yeah.
Okay. And does anybody happen to have that link that they could?
I'm trying to find it. I'm trying to find his
right. Is there
email,
anybody else who's online while Neil is looking that happens to have that link that could dictate it?
Right. I would. Let me give you the link. It's a long link, but I don't. It's a little bit too long.
Okay, never mind then.
Yeah. No,
I'll muddle along. It's okay.
I did send it to several people. Did anybody else there get it? Oh boy, probably a lot of people that I sent it to aren't on today.
An email from you with a link.
I sent it to Chazanet. So when you say you didn't get it,
That must be why, because I'm not on Hazanet.
Oh.
I think I'm not on Hazanet either.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah,
because
I still don't. I'm still not sure how to get onto Hazanet because nobody has given me any information about that.
Yeah, I'll tell you after. You go to Jeff Schroen, and he'll put you on right away. As long as you're a member of the CA, they'll put you on.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Do you see it yet, Neil?
I am not finding anything from you beyond January 16th. I don't know what the heck's wrong with my search engine here.
Why don't you go ahead, Richie, and just...
1 second. February 5th, I sent it. I have it here.
Yeah. And I'm just, it's not bringing up anything that...
I'll go ahead. Basically, the article would have been very helpful, as I say, because my computer, I never thought I would have to print it out because I had my computer, and unfortunately, the storm killed it. But anyway, he's talking about the people that are so medoctic, so meticulous and so particular about the Kol Isha problem. It gets to a point where he's saying it's like this Orthodox rabbi, I think his name is Freundel, Rabbi Barry Freundel, he is basically saying that it becomes absurd, that they become more involved and more interested in the minutiae as opposed to the you know, as we say, the spirit of the law. You know, you have
okay, time out. I found the link. I found your original. It was called Forward Assignment for a Halakha Class. If one at a time, everybody who doesn't have this, I'll type in your email addresses and send it to all of you at once. Linda Sue, why don't you go first?
Sure, it's Linda Sue at cantoreducator.com.
LINDASUE at
cantoreducator.com. Cantoreducator is all one word.
Yep. .com. Let me just see how that came out. Linda Sue at cantoreducator.com. Okay, next. Who else said they didn't get it? I thought I heard at least another female voice.
I did too. But anyway, you can send it to her. And now click on it and
all right.
Would start reading.
All right, let
it
me at least send this to you, Linda Sue.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And,
I don't know why
Linda,
it wouldn't come up the first time on my search engine.
All right, Linda, afterwards I'll tell you how to get on Hazanet. Very
simple.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah, no problem. So would you, Neil, read that?
Let me get it back up. I was so concerned about getting it sent out that I didn't actually open it.
You didn't get it.
Okay.
What do you want read, Richie? It's too long
article. Here we go.
Okay,
which one do you want me to read first, Richie?
The first one. Bobby, is that you? Who said to go on?
Ted Prov.
Yeah, no.
Okay, go ahead.
Ofer Ben Sharit. All right, I'll read the one about Ofer Ben Sharit, this Israeli teenager. All right. News of the suspension from school of Ofer Ben Shatrit for performing on the Israeli hit show The Voice in violation of her school's policy of Kol Isha, ban women singing public, is now well known. School's decision to suspend Ofer is theirs alone. It is also true that schools have the right to discipline students for breaking the rules. No one should fault the school for implementing a standing policy. Having said that, this story does offer an opportunity to discuss an issue that is present when rendering halakhic rulings.
Neil, let's try to get the heart of it, because it can get boring if you read the whole thing. I had it outlined already, but basically, this girl was kicked out of the yeshiva for publicly performing. Okay, what happens then?
This article doesn't give it any conclusion. At the point of this article, it was still up in the air as to whether she'd be allowed back in school.
Read the end of it, the last paragraph of it.
How Ofer will react to a very strict interpretation that ostracizes her by marginalizing other equally valid interpretations is anyone's guess. What is so disappointing here is that halakha is being used to drive people away from observance instead of being used to bring them closer.
Yeah, that's good. That's what I wanted to point out. that halacha is actually being utilized to turn people off as opposed to doing the opposite. And that was a very great insight. Click on the second link now, if you would.
No problem. Get back to the article. And by the way, that's part of the Rabbi Barry Freundel thing, too, is he's saying the same thing that
exactly
halacha is being
that's
pushing
why
to
I
people.
Gave,
okay, so this time I will ask, what parts of it do you or do you not want me to read? Because this one's almost as long.
Start the beginning and go to the middle and then the end. I don't want to take
too
much time.
Rabbi Freundel has weighed in on the topic of partnership minyanim, opening his review with a lament that halacha has been quote, the silent partner in the development of partnership minyanim, unquote, and concluding that there is no halachic justification for women to lead tefillah. I suggest that Rabbi Freundel check out Women and Men in Communal Prayer, Halachic Perspectives, a book published in 2010 by Ketav and JOFA, and welcome him as a new partner in the dialogue. And this is coming from Chaim Trachtman. Okay, again, at the end, he's basically saying that for those like Rabbi Sperber and Shapiro who have written in support of partnership in Yanim, I fully respect Rabbi Freundel's detailed response, but I would hope that he sees modern orthodoxy as broad enough to include those who adopt practices that differ from his own. So actually, I have a question for you, Richie. I read all three segments of Freundel's articles, and I read the other guy's responses in between them. It wasn't entirely clear to me exactly where Freundel stands on this. Is he really supporting it, or is he saying that, you know, it's just not supportable halachically?
It's a good question.
Did you get a clear reading?
Yes. What's happening is he's torn. You see, and this is what I wanted to bring out.
I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah, and
definitely torn.
It's almost like, okay, I knew there were certain rabbis that would not even shake hands with a woman. That was absolutely against, you know, they would never shake hands with a woman. Now, most modern Orthodox rabbis in America that have pulpits feel obligated to if a woman comes over to shake hands out of respect for the woman, le kavod habriyot. He still may feel torn, but in a sense, he feels that one overrides the other. And Freundel felt the same thing, that there are certain things that override, and that's where common sense comes in. And with that, I'm going to lead into something that's very, very much similar to that. That will sort of enhance that situation. I have to find it here because one second here. I have.
While you're looking, I was reminded from one of the articles that I think Freundel actually wrote one of the new books out where the left wing of modern orthodoxy is dealing with the larger issue of is it time to start loosening the reins a little bit on the development of liturgy now that we're in the 21st century and, you know, letting slight modifications come into the Orthodox services.
Hold on one second.
Rabbi Barry Freundel also wrote a very interesting book called Why We Pray, What We Pray. Now listen to the subtitle. The Remarkable History of Jewish Prayer. So I think he is in recognizing that halakha evolves over time. The prayer service was not fixed at Sinai. And he goes through some of the historical background, how tefillah has changed.
Right.
Absolutely. Because bear in mind, you do know, obviously, that tefillah was really in lieu of the karbanot. In other words, there was never tefillah. There was little. I mean, you have the tillum and so on. But in the time of the temples, the form of worship was through sacrifices, so that once the temples were destroyed, then they had to find a way of of the avodah, and hence it became it went to prayers, and that's why they had all kinds of prayers and all kinds of how they formulated it. So what you're saying is very true. Very, very, very true.
But it was specifically for the Amidah, I think, Richie. Not for the Shema section. I think it was specific with the Amidah, which replaced
the Shema. The Shema is a Torah obligation, but there wasn't formal davening per se. They had the korbanot, and that was what they that's what they did. Let's see here. I had that all set. And because of everything that's happened here, I didn't even think I'd be able to make the class because of the telephone being out. Yeah, you have something to say?
Well, while you're looking, I was going to point out that one of the things that came out of the series of the Freundel articles and his responses for this other guy's main reason, not Trachman, but the other guy who did the responding for two out of the three articles, was that they were differentiating between Kabbalat Shabbat and Arvit LaShabbat in terms of whether or not there's enough of a halakhic difference that they're comfortable with women leading Kabbalat Shabbat in Tefillah B'Tzibur in a mixed minyan, because it doesn't have brachot, and because it came into the liturgy in the 1600s, in the 16th century, 1500s, and they were arguing back and forth about the difference, whether or not the chumrah, the strictness, applies to Kabbalat Shabbat as well as to the Shema Birchotah and the Amidah section.
Well, right, because the Kabbalat service was prior. It was like an intro anyway.
It's a very late addition to the services.
Right. I found it. Okay, so here's what's going to sort of amplify what we said. You've all heard of the famous Rabbi Soloveitchik. Okay, he discusses, and I'm bringing this out because the Porsha Mishpatim follows the, obviously, Yitro, the Ten Commandments, and so on. He discusses the importance of Nezikin. Nezikin is literally tort law, but a general expression for all civil law matters within Torah scholarship. So the fourth, you know, there are like six orders of the Talmud. The fourth Seder of the Mishnah is actually entitled Nezikin. And while its first tractate does deal with tort law and negligence, the subjects of property, business law, and the court system are all prominent within the Seder of Nezikin. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asserts clearly that the historical tradition of Jewish scholarship truly gave a special precedence to the study of this subject. And follow me, because you'll see where it's going to, and it becomes very interesting. His further argument is that given the placement of these laws as the dominant subject of the Torah portion that follows the... Hello?
No, that was just my computer saying that it's 3:30.
Oh, okay. So his further argument is that the placement of these laws as the dominant subject of the Torah portion that follows the Aseret HaDibrot, it would actually seem to be a preference introduced by God himself. As he writes, I quote, "Apparently Mishpatim are footnotes to the Aseret HaDibrot." In fact, I've heard it said that the Aseret HaDibrot, if you subdivided them, you'd get all 613 mitzvot. But he's saying it's the footnotes of the Aseret HaDibrot. If this is so, this would seem to clearly substantiate the importance of civil law within the corpus of Torah. And again, follow me, because I'm going somewhere with this. His further question, though, is why should this be so? Why should civil law issues have such a dominant place within Torah thought and scholarship? In formulating this question, he presents an assumption that Torah should really only be concerned with moral laws and issues. thus leading us to wonder why it would be concerned with civil issues in general. Now, I can tell you in Massachusetts law, and there's a big difference between civil and criminal matters. Also, a lot of these things even change and evolve. Under, for instance, in Massachusetts, it's no longer a crime to smoke or have under an ounce of marijuana. This has been decriminalized, but it is a civil violation, an administrative violation, for which the person is issued a $100 ticket. So it's like going through a red light. Now, but here comes the difference between that and the Torah law. This question Rav Soloveitchik is posing, why civil law issues have such a dominant place within Torah thought and scholarship? And this is really a twofold question. One, why should Torah be concerned with civil law matters at all? And two, once it is concerned, why does it then give such primacy to this study? His answer builds upon the simple idea that the original assumption was obviously incorrect. Yahadus, Judaism, not only deals with morality, it deals with everything else in human life. This, however, meant, if you recall, the very first thing I said to you, the very first lesson we had was, the Shulchan Aruch has laws from the time you wake up until you go to sleep. It tells you how to even to put your shoes on. So this is the difference. This, however, is not to say that Torah deals with amoral, meaning something that is neither moral or immoral, or secular or profane issues. The Torah doesn't tell you, for instance, what to have for breakfast or what kind of washing machine you should purchase. The reality is that the very discussion of certain issues within Torah inherently transforms them into moral issues. For instance, I study the Torah, which prima facie has no relationship to morality, and on the contrary, it is all morality. So if somebody would say they study Torah to somebody that's not knowledgeable, they say that has nothing to do with morality. We say it is all morality. If the Torah deals with this problem, this itself transforms the problem into a moral one. You know, it's the same thing. We take physical acts like eating and we elevate it. We make them holy. The very primacy given to Nezikin, which is, means damages, is a reinforcement of this point. For instance, now, have any of you ever heard the term Das Torah? There are certain individuals that are well known for their knowledge of Torah, and they're called Das Torah. And for instance, certain Rosh Yeshiva, certain people like, and of course the Lubavitcher Rebbe was one. All day and sometimes all night, they would see people every 15 minutes. And the people would come with all kinds of questions. You say, well, they'd ask a question, who should I marry? Where should I move to? Which yeshiva should my kid go to? They go on and on and on. And you'd be saying, why are they asking a rabbi? Let them go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a good friend. But the answer is that they see this person as Das Torah, as so imbued with Torah that they feel they're going to get the best answer. I can tell you from a personal point of view, when I was a teenager, I went through a terrible period where I wanted to become very religious. My parents were never religious. There was a tremendous amount of friction and so on. And at the yeshiva I went to, they had me write a letter to Rabbi Schneerson. And Rabbi Schneerson sent me back a response. Are you all still there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because my phone is making crazy noises. Anyway, I'll tell you very interestingly, and this is another thing that turned me off from Orthodoxy. He sends back his letter saying that I should say Kapitel Tillim every day. It's almost like, you know, this magic stuff. You say Tillim, and you say three Hail Marys and all and so on before you know it, and everything will be fine. Well, it wasn't fine, and he was way off. But nevertheless, that's what people go to him for, and there's many, many stories to the opposite, that people will claim he saved their life and he gave them the best information and so on. But I can tell you personally he didn't do it for me. Now, why should this, however, be so? simply stating that the Torah's discussion of an issue makes this issue a moral one would seem problematic. Now, the fourth, again, the fourth Seder of the Mishnah is actually titled Nezikin, and while its first tractate does deal with Torah law, which is a wrongful act or an infringement of a right, leading to legal liability, Nezikin also deals with negligence. And I already said that. Okay, so another possibility, though, may be that the Torah is not really challenging our basic idea of what is moral, but rather is calling upon us to recognize that this issue actually touches upon more aspects of life than we might think. The call then would be to understand why this issue is, in fact, a moral one, even though we never perceived it as such. With either possibility, though, the Torah would seem to indeed be challenging us to reconsider what we believe to be the essence of morality. Now, I can think of a perfect example. You've all heard the term caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. Yeah, right. In Judaism, it's just the opposite. It's vendita emptor. Let the seller beware. Now, that would be alien plus, but in Judaism, that's very important.
Nice.
It appears that one approach the Rav takes is to articulate a different definition of what we may term morality. He speaks of inspiration and how the study of Torah can inspire, and this is no less so with the study of Nezikin, no matter what you study. It is often difficult to clearly define what we mean by moral, but we know that it touches upon an issue beyond the limits of the pragmatic and touches upon a subject of right and wrong on some higher plane. The Rav may be expanding this definition to inform us that the term moral might actually further extend beyond the parameters of this axis of right and wrong, extending to a level of insight that touches upon an aspect of the divine in that it inspires. This would also include the Torah study of Nezikin. Now, giving a smile to a dejected person, you wouldn't think much of it. This can be one of the greatest mitzvot that you'll ever do, and hence quite moral. Many times you hear of someone that was on the brink of suicide, the verge of suicide, and so on, and someone did one nice thing, and that made the difference to consider not to do it. On the other hand, not giving a smile would not necessarily be considered immoral. So there's actually in the Talmud somewhere, it talks about if somebody shows the white of their teeth, it's a great thing. The metaphor was if they smile. And it actually says sometimes a smile is even more important than giving tzedakah to somebody. Another similar approach that one finds in the words of the Rav concerns the intellectual challenge found in the study of Torah civil law. The Gemara Baba Basra, 175b, quotes Rabbi Ishmael as stating that one who wishes to become wise should delve into the study of Nezikin. In other words, become a lawyer, basically, is what I'm saying. The question, though, is what is the connection between this intellectual study and morality or spiritual pursuits? And I purposely said become a lawyer because there's nothing more. Becoming a lawyer isn't a morality issue. A person becomes a lawyer in this society for whatever reason, they make money and so on. In Judaism, it's very much a morality issue. That's the whole point. So what connection between the study and morality or spiritual pursuits? So, Torah, Tamima, it's a midrash on Shemot. It points out that there is no greater attribute for comprehending the realm of the spiritual than thought. If we understand morality as an insight into the realm of the spiritual, and we recognize intellectual study as would be undertaken in the study of Torah civil law as an entryway to this plane, then we perhaps have another way of understanding the inherent moral nature of this Torah study. You know, it'd be like if you looked at a door, just a plain door, you didn't know, You didn't know. You didn't know where it was, what it was or anything. You looked at the door and you opened it. All of a sudden, you'd be amazed at what is inside. The door itself is nothing. And that's the same thing. The tractate is nothing until you open it, and then you get your treasure. Now, until we open the door, it may very well look like an old dilapidated door that needed to be painted or fixed, all of which meant nothing until we opened it. There may, however, still be another approach. I hear a little something there. There may be another approach reflecting the second possibility that I said, the intellectual challenge found in the study of civil law. Our question is, why would it be important for the Torah to inform us that, for example, one of the ways to validly transfer ownership of a field is through a transaction involving money? The assumption that the Torah deals with issues of morality, that is, issues of right and wrong, leads us to wonder why the Torah would voice a thought on an issue such as the method of transferring property. What does that have to do with right and wrong or whatever? In that this study, as part of Torah, can inspire and is highly intellectually challenging, the above answers are that this is part of Torah, for it reflects a higher realm of what Torah study is, beyond the issue of simple right and wrong. So, see, the whole point is that Torah Lishma, just the study of it is immoral. Morality is right and wrong is but only a part of this broader divine realm of study. It may, however, be that civil law is part of Torah because it is indeed part of this very issue of morality, defined as articulating essentially the distinction between right and wrong. If you go into the study of law, I mean, everything is a matter of what's right, what's wrong, what you could do, what you can't do, and so on. And this fundamentally is the essence of Torah. And the difference between Torah, let's say, and civil law is if it's a matter of civil law, you don't see that as a moral issue. You just see it as a legal issue. You get there's a fine point here, the difference between a legal issue and a moral issue. The real challenge is to comprehend why something is right and something else is not. Right and wrong are not just arbitrary terms, but they reflect the ultimate, desired, divine structure and objective. Morality is not just knowing right from wrong, but also knowing fully why one thing is right and another wrong. It is only through an understanding of matters such as how property can be transferred that we can understand the moral directives connected to it. So in studying Nezikin, our goal is to understand the very base upon which right and wrong are built. Now, I'll give you an example. There are people today, in this day and age, 2013, there are people who sit and study the tractates of the Talmud that strictly deal with sacrifices, with karbonos. They can tell you from A to Z everything about a sacrifice and which ones you bring and when and how and so on and so on. You say, well, what is the purpose of that? They legitimately, the feeling is that when the Mashiach comes and the third temple is built, they will be ready to go out and to, do what they have to do. So that basically is the section on Nezikin, the study, and I brought it out also because it deals with it has to deal with Mishpatim, which we just read. Now there must be some feedback on what I just said. Sounds like somebody's eating supper.
I actually have a question about one thing we haven't spent much time talking about, which is acts of omission versus acts of commission.
Right. Well, that's a very important category. So, for instance, not putting on tefillin is an act of omission.
Right.
Is that would
but
be
I'm thinking
a,
more in the moral realm, like walking away when somebody's drowning. Rather than taking a chance on getting hurt in the process of saving them, that, it's a murky area of law. you haven't broken any laws by not going and saving them, but on the other hand, morally, that act of omission could be considered a serious transgression.
This will surprise you, because I have a feeling you're articulating what you would believe to be true. I don't think you ever saw that, and I'll tell you why. The Talmud actually gives the following situation. You're in the midbar. You're in the wilderness. You're in the desert. You have enough water to keep one person alive. You're required to keep it for yourself. You have to think of yourself first. Imeili meili. So the answer to your question is, if you saw a person drowning and it was a matter of risking your life to save them, you're actually not allowed to. What you said is the opposite. And I'm glad you said that, because at least now you're seeing what Jewish law is. There's a very big pragmatic involvement. Now, that doesn't mean to say that if you went to save them that you're committing a sin, but basically Torah law is that you have to first consider your own safety. And we're not talking about a Kiddush Hashem where you're told to kill somebody or they'll kill you. We're not talking about that at all. We're talking about exactly the example you just gave, that if there's a situation where, let's say somebody just had a terrible automobile accident and you know the car is going to go into flames within 10 seconds, you're really not – actually, Jewish law is that there's nothing you can do. That doesn't mean to say there haven't been heroes that have done it. Did anybody ever see the movie or ever hear of – I always get the two confused. It's either Audie Murphy or Bridie Murphy. It was a war hero who was a Michigana, and he went and – does anybody ever hear of him? I guess it's before your time.
I've heard the name, but I don't remember the plot line of the movie.
He was a war hero, and he went and shot up the whole – thing and so on, but they later found out he was bipolar, and what he did, it looked like it was a heroic act, and he was nuts. That basically, so there are people that will come out as heroes even though what they did was not anything that Judaism would sanction. So in answer to what you said, by omission, it wouldn't mean that. When you mentioned, I mentioned tefillin. To religious people, it's a ritual, but again, it has to do with a certain morality. But I'll give you a better one of omission that is Jewish law. You observe a crime, and you don't go to court witness. That's a serious violation of Jewish law. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
There. You're absolutely supposed to, appear as a witness and so on. Another thing, it says if you see the weight of your enemy fall or something, you're supposed to go help him pick it up. And that's a beautiful law, because it's saying kal v'chomer, if you're supposed to help your enemy, how much more so you should be helping your friend. So.
And that is actually Deoraita.
That's your right, sir. Absolutely.
Yep.
Now, the other thing that is interesting, the other thing is it talks about what's the difference between revenge and a grudge. And it says you're not supposed to have either. I'm sure you've all heard this before, but it bears repetition. Somebody comes and you go to somebody and ask to borrow his lawnmower. And he said, no, sorry. Okay. Next day, I have a better one. We'll make it more contemporary. It's heavy snow. You ask to borrow his shovel. And he says, no. Next year. Somehow his shovel broke. You got a shovel. He comes to you and asks you for a shovel, to borrow the shovel. Revenge would be no. Grudge would be, even though you didn't let me borrow your shovel last year, I'm going to let you borrow mine. That's against Jewish law also. Very hard to, you know, it's very hard to be that way. But what it's saying is that, you know, you're not allowed to do that. But again, a sin of omission is the examples I gave, and I'm glad you brought up, Neil, because the thing you said actually is not supposed to be that way. The problem of halacha and morality, and this is the thing that I wanted to bring out for the last few minutes. The problem of halacha and morality arises in its most acute form with regard to mitzvot that clearly contradict our moral standards. Our starting point must be that when a mitzvah clearly contradicts our moral principles, we must, without a doubt, follow the mitzvah. So what great event in history would we all say that none of us could have followed? The Akedah. How many of you, if God said kill your kid, would you kill? In fact, there's an Orthodox rabbi that I was communicating with, and he said something, and then it was rather again, it was one of the stereotypical things that bothered me. I wish I could remember what it was. And then I said to him, I said, you just had a granddaughter. So if God told you to sacrifice your granddaughter, would you do it? And fortunately, he was honest. He said, absolutely not. He said, absolutely not, because I'm not, God wouldn't ask me to do it because I'm not capable of doing it. So that's almost like a syllogism. I mean, it's like saying, well, God wouldn't ask because I can't do it. So the point is that if something contradicts our moral principles, according to law, you're supposed to follow it. And they say proof can be adduced from the story of the Akedah. And the very same Avraham who expected that God conduct himself in a moral manner with regard to the destruction of Sodom and Amorah was himself prepared to execute an absolutely immoral divine command to sacrifice his son without any protest or hesitation. So according to that thinking, our duty to God supersedes our duty to moral principles. But I can tell you there's plenty of poskim who criticized Avraham for the fact that he was doing. You know the old saying, we're just following orders? That's the famous, in the Holocaust, the Nazis that tried to get out. They said, we were just following orders. But, of course, the answer would be there's a difference in orders from Hitler and orders from God. But in general, we try to avoid such a situation. From where do we derive the authority to fashion the mitzvot in such a manner that they do not clash with morality? And it seems that we may learn from the example presented by Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Lord spoke to me, saying, behold, I have given into your hand Sihon, the Amorite, king of Cheshbon, and his land, began to possess it and contend with him in battle, and I sent messengers out, and so on, with words of peace. So God commanded Moses to fight Sihon, yet Moses sent him messengers of peace. You could say, how did Moshe dare to deviate from the instructions received directly from God? But the fact of the matter is, he was able to interpret it another way. I mean, and Rashi explains, although God had not commanded me to offer peace to Sihon, I learned to do so from what happened in the wilderness of Sinai, from an incident that relates to the Torah. So that's how he got around it. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is because this is the same thing for Kol Isha. This Rabbi Freundel was smart enough to find a way of allowing it under certain circumstances. You see, Chazal tell us why Moshe dared to veer from the simple meaning of God's instructions. When Moshe came to interpret God's words, he took into consideration what he knew of God's moral nature. Indeed, according to the plain meaning of what he said, God seems to have desired immediate engagement in battle. but that's not exactly what, you know, what the intention was. One of the things we have a big, big problem with, and it's, they've always discussed it, is when we were told to obliterate Amalek, you remember that? Man, woman, child, animal became a very, very big problem. I mean, how can you go killing everybody? Would you, if you were told to go kill a whole nation, how could you do it? And the only thing I can think of is when Harry Truman dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were many innocent people killed. There's no doubt about it. However, it was pointed out that if the bomb hadn't been dropped, there would have been many, many, many more Americans that would have been killed, and many more innocent people that have been killed. And to make this contemporary, there's a whole big hullabaloo going on now about the drones. Are you all familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I think it's sad that innocent people are accidentally killed. But again, it's for the greater good, because the person they're killing is capable of killing a lot more people than might be being killed when he is killed. So it's a very sensitive issue. Another one. It says,
this is just my ignorance speaking. This is Linda Sue. I think that there's a difference, and I think even just in my reading of the scriptures that there's a difference between what governments do to each other in peace or in war versus what individuals do to each other.
Absolutely. Well,
and so I think that a lot of the meets vote don't really apply to governments per se, but apply to people, individual people. So if you're an agent of war, if you're a soldier, now you're an agent of the government and its policies.
Right, right. But I mean, and what you're saying is true, but how are you applying it? I'm trying to understand where.
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, I'm wondering where you're going with trying to equate halakha with how governments behave in war. I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, I'm talking now, and I'm talking strictly. I can't speak halakha for let's say, United States, but I can tell you in biblical times, the point was that they first had to try peaceful. It's the same thing with Esau and Yaakov. You first have to try peaceful measures, and then if peaceful measures don't work, we are definitely mandated to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
That's not against halakha to go to war.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And I drew a parallel saying, to me, what the United States is doing is very similar, because they're trying to eliminate this the Al Qaeda.
Right. Well, Truman. I mean, in the case of Truman, I mean, Truman certainly gave the Japanese fair warning that he was going to
do
something.
Exactly. Oh, I didn't criticize him.
No. I know you didn't. But I'm just adding for the sake of historical accuracy that he didn't capriciously throw two bombs at.
Of course not.
Them. And so, I mean, the only thing that I guess that I had, that I would have had an issue with in terms of the decision that they made, is that they specifically, both on Nagasaki and on Hiroshima, that they did not have any other bombs dropped in those areas. And that was for the sake of science, to see what the effect of the atomic bombs would have on those areas. And that's amazing.
I didn't get what your objection is.
My objection is that in the course of preparing to drop those bombs,
right,
that bombs that were dropped in other areas of Japan were specifically mandated not to be dropped on those two areas, that those two areas were off limits to the bombers. to American bombers, and because this, for the sake of science, they wanted to see what the effect of the atomic bombs would have on those regions. That to me is a little dastardly. So
what you're saying is they dropped atomic bombs on other areas just as a test?
Nope. They had non-atomic bombs. They were bombing the heck out of Japan, because they had gotten that far forward in their
right.
in their offense,
right.
in their offensive line. But the non-atomic bomber planes were specifically directed not to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I see.
And, you know, that's very willful in terms of kind of saving that region for the destruction that they knew was going to be coming. And, you know, that's...
I got you.
Yeah. That's the only part that I had, you know.
Right.
To me, there's you know, a commission act, you know, of... You know, you're going to be harming civilians in that case.
Oh yeah,
and it's coming.
It's obviously, and if it was us, it would be horrible.
Right.
I mean, you know, but we're about done now. Any further comments or?
Well, speaking of planning, and with Purim coming up, not halakha, but just a comment about minchag. You mentioned the commandment to obliterate Amalek.
Right.
So one custom during Purim is people would write Haman's name on the soles of their shoes.
Right, and bang their foot.
In order to erase his name.
Right.
It wasn't so much the banging, it was the rubbing out of his name.
You're right. It was the rubbing. You're absolutely right. And I should have known that. But of course, today they do bang their feet without Haman's name on their shoe.
Without understanding that's where the custom came from.
Right, of course. And with that said and done, I will touch upon Purim. I have nice halachas for Purim that'll interest you. I also have things about. Talking about the difference between, and this is something that you can think about for next week, the difference between intention, doing something with intention, and doing something perfunctorily. So, I mean, does the action have to be infused with intent, or does the mere fact of doing it fulfill the mitzvah? It's an interesting question. It's not an easy black and white answer because it's whole machlokas about it anyway. But remind me, we could begin with that next week and any other thing, and hopefully the weather will be a lot better than it was this week.
And next week's our last session, right?
Next week is the last one. Say the 10th?
Yeah,
next week's the last one. Yep. I purposely have Purim. I say Purim for next week because it's right in the vicinity of Purim. So, and also... today is Rosh Chodesh, by the way, and tomorrow is the first of Adar. Interestingly, I might have brought this out, and I may. The Talmud says that if you have a lawsuit against a non-Jew, a good time to bring it is an Adar because we have good luck then. So, what bothered me about that is, well, what if the non-Jew is correct? So anyway, you can think about that for next week. And I thank you all for your attention and look forward to seeing you all next week.
Thanks for sharing.
Okay.
Sure.
Take care,
y'all. Bye-bye now. Oh, who wants to know how to get on Kazanet? Did she leave?
I don't know. Linda Sue, are you still there? All right, so you know what, Richie? Richie, are you still there?